Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Nathan Hobson, your host for this episode of the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, in which I'll be talking with Dr. Maren Ehlers about her book, Give and Take, Poverty and the Status Order in Early Modern Japan. In this book, which is out from the Harvard University Asia Center in 2018, Dr. Ehlers examines the management and regulation of poverty in Tokugawa Japan, focusing on self-governing, occupation-based, and other status groups, especially the so-called beggar bosses and blind guilds. The title, Give and Take, is part of the book's argument about the ways in which their relationship to government was one of reciprocity between ostensibly benevolent rulers and duty-bound status groups. Through a detailed examination of an extraordinary collection of primary sources from the castle town of Ono, in modern Fukui Prefecture, Ehlers enriches our understanding of the complex dynamics of interconnectivity and reciprocity that characterized Japan under Tokugawa rule. Okay, so Dr. Ehlers, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd like to first ask you a little bit about the background of the book. How did you become interested in this topic? And in particular, how did you become interested in this location, right? You're focused on a very specific location.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast and giving me a chance to talk about my book. I think the initial reason I got interested in poverty in Tokugawa, Japan as a grad student was that this was a way for me to see Tokugawa, Japan through a somewhat less romantic lens. I was a student of Japanology, Japanese studies at the University of Hamburg at the time, and I had done quite a bit of work on Japanese literature, taking seminars. And I think there is a temptation that a lot of Tokugawa specialists recognize to romanticize this as the period of geisha and kabuki and woodblock prints. And I think I was consciously reacting to that by focusing on economic difficulties, issues of power and marginalization. And poor relief was especially interesting to me because I thought it would help me understand how the poor were embedded in society, that I wouldn't just focus on the poor in isolation, but that it would give me a chance to see how they related to people higher up the social chain interactions between social classes. And when I entered graduate school, when I started my PhD, I went to Japan for 2 years, and my interest in marginalized people brought me in touch with a certain research group of social historians in the early 2000s, the so-called Status Marginality Research Group, which had formed in the 1990s. And it consisted of Marxist historians with a strong interest in underclass issues. I was particularly working with Tsukada Takashi initially at Osaka City University, and then also with Yoshida Nobuyuki. And this was a pretty large group of scholars at various universities. And they were working on the premise that the status order was dynamic and was changing over time. They were trying to go against this view of these fixed status categories assigned from above, like this hierarchy of the four estates, the samurai on top, and then the peasants and the artisans and merchants. And then there would be the outcasts as people who didn't really have a status, who were not placed within this hierarchy of status. And these scholars had gathered a lot of evidence that simply didn't fit in with this model, and they were looking for a better way to explain how status was assigned. And this led them to conduct a lot of empirical research, particularly on groups that were at the margins of society, because these scholars believed that it was at the margins of society, really, that the status order was the most dynamic and the most fluid and ambiguous. And it turned out, it was turning out in the early 2000s that the status order as a whole was actually pretty dynamic. It wasn't just at the margins, but definitely the margins were the most interesting subjects of research in the beginning, and there was a lot of empirical research being piled up on groups like itinerant clerics and entertainers and beggar guilds. And I came into this situation. I started to read a lot of their work, and it took me a while to process how this work would actually be relevant for me to understand poverty and poor relief in general, because I mean, when we think of these mendicant groups, I mean, it's pretty obvious they were marginal even among the poor. The large majority of the Tokugawa poor were not a part of a mendicant group or a group of street entertainers or something like that. But when I started to work with Ono's sources, and I think I will explain in a moment why I picked this local case, and I saw these groups operating in the context of one local society, I realized that they absorbed poor commoners on a regular basis, and their existence had a lot of impact on how poor people in other status groups, how they led their lives. And I also picked these groups of entertainers and beggars and so on, picked up on the same logic of governance as other subjects in Tokugawa society. They tried to protect their livelihood by acting collectively. They tried to get recognized by the authorities and perform a duty that would make them seem useful in the eyes of the authorities. And certainly these mendicant groups were a bit special because the protection that they received from the government typically involved the protection of begging rights. But quote-unquote respectable commoners were also using similar strategies. They were using occupational associations as a vehicle for getting privileges, protections, and sometimes they used them to ask the government for poor relief if this was necessary. So in that sense, the marginal groups weren't quite so marginal after all. And it became clear to me that for poor and marginalized people, there was a particularly strong incentive to form new occupational groups. And the first reason was that they struggled to find stable sources of income. And so they became quite creative in trying to monopolize a new livelihood and try to get that protected. And very often, poor people did not have a land or a house. And owning a land or a house was really a condition of being a full member in one of the most established status groups in Tokugawa society, the villages and the cho. And if you were not a full member of one of these groups, then you could not directly interact with the authorities. You could not hold office in one of these groups. And so the only way for these kinds of people to formally interact with the authorities would have been to form their own group and perform duties of some kind for the government.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things I think you said there was the way that these ostensibly sort of marginal groups, in fact, in many ways are not marginal in that the way that they interact with society echoes the structures of society at large. And so by examining these groups out on these, again, ostensible sort of margins, you're able to see something very profound about society itself. And I think it's one of the sort of strengths of the work that you're doing here. And I guess it tells us a little bit about how they fit into the overall picture of the Edo period. And of course, you've talked about the way that your interest in poverty was a way for you to de-romanticize Tokugawa, which I found also quite interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about the period in which you decided to work, which you've decided to work specifically on 1740 to 1870? Also, geographically, you limit yourself to the castle town of Ono, which is in Fukui Prefecture, modern-day Fukui. Can you tell us about those choices? So why Ono, why that period? And after that, if you could, I'd love for you to tell us about some of the remarkable primary sources that you got to work with for this study?
Sure. That's a really interesting question. Hearing that, I'm realizing I really, for me, the geographic selection was a lot more conscious, a lot more intentional than the temporal selection. The time period between 1740 and 1870 came, I defined that because I chose Ono as a case study. The sources that were available about that place simply are the most abundant during that time period. That is to say, before that time, we really don't have much. So it was almost by necessity that I chose that. The reason why I wanted to focus on one town had to do with the structure of the status order. Because I really wanted to connect the study of poverty, of poor relief, with this structure of the social order and of government more generally. And what I learned really from the status marginality scholars was that status groups, I mean, they were not these broad categories that cut all across the country. I mean, status itself was something that was intelligible all over the country. Everybody knew what a samurai was and what a peasant was and what a townsperson was. But the groups that were in charge of assigning status by deciding membership within the, or determining the membership within their groups, and those were pretty small. I mean, a cho or a village confraternity or a guild, a trade or craft guild. I mean, these groups, they could range from a handful of members to maybe a couple of dozen, in some cases over 100 or so. But they weren't really particularly large, and they were also incredibly diverse all over the country. And so to understand how they interacted on the local on the local level is really important for understanding government during that period. And doing that on a countrywide level, I mean, it would be completely impossible. I found it already incredibly complex just to work on one place. I had initially other cities and other towns in mind that I wanted to compare to Ono, and I realized that just looking at this one town gave me plenty to work with. There was so little that I knew about how these relatively small occupational groups worked with each other and how they interacted with various levels of government. And I was really interested in this complexity. And I picked Ono. Partly by coincidence, I was in Fukui at the time. I was doctor. I was not. I was a foreign exchange student at the a research student at the University of Fukui, and my host professor there, Matsuda Yoshinori, recommended Ono to me because he said, for this kind of topic where you look at the urban underclass, Ono is really the best within the prefecture. And that had to do with the fact that Ono hadn't been bombed in World War II. Tsuruga had been bombed heavily. Fukui had also been heavily bombed and had gone through an earthquake after World War II. A lot of sources on town society didn't exist anymore, whereas in Ono, there was a lot. And that happened to be concentrated between 1740 and 1870. I'm not entirely sure why there were no journals between 1740. There probably were some that might have burned at some point. I'm not sure. But I happened to I then concentrated on 1740 to 1870 because especially the town elders' journals were preserved only for that time. And that periodization doesn't necessarily work for all of the aspects that I'm interested in. And so readers of my book will notice that I bring in material from other places where I feel like I need to fill some holes. So when I wrote about the beggar guilds, I had to supplement examples from other places to explain why these guilds even existed. Because there is no evidence from Ono itself, I can only speculate about the roots of Ono's guild of beggar bosses. And I think I can make some fairly educated guesses from what happens in other castle towns, and I brought that in. And I do that in a couple of other instances as well. And Yeah, so in that sense, the geographical focus came first. And as I said, I don't really think about that focus as a limitation. It's something that can be incredibly enriching, and it kind of serves as a magnifying glass on all these social interactions that were, on the one hand, central to how the Tokugawa state worked and practiced. You can make this a very big point about how the Tokugawa state worked, but you can also look into the nitty-gritty detail and write basically a micro history of government under the status order.
Yeah, and I thought that was one of the strengths of the book. Can you tell us a little bit more about the sources? You mentioned that there were journals of the town elders. What were those like? Where were they preserved? What was the collection like? Yeah.
So the journals of the town elders are really my most important, my richest source. The two town elders were basically at the intersection between the domain government and the townspeople. They were townspeople themselves. They were elite members of town society, and they were responsible for passing on petitions of making sure that domain orders got executed, and passing on information, consulting with the domain government about policy. Sometimes representing the townspeople, sometimes representing the domain government. So they were really at the intersection, and their journals reflect that. A lot of this interaction between the various groups in town society and on the one hand, and the domain government on the other hand. And that meant that they had insight not just into townspeople's affairs, not just into the affairs of the Chō and the trade and crafts guilds, but they also had jurisdiction over the mendicant guilds, about several villages in the vicinity of the town. They knew a lot about temples and shrines and their parishioners and tenants, and they even dealt with agricultural issues. So, what these journals don't do is that they were not produced within the occupational communities themselves, and so we get only glimpses of that. But they do tell us a lot about the relationships between groups. And today, these journals, there are over 80 volumes of them still preserved. This is a huge amount of material. They are actually in a private archive today. They were, after the Meiji Restoration, they seem to have been in the possession of the town hall. And there they got borrowed by a local historian, and then it ended up in his private archive. But I got access to them through photographic reproductions that are today available in the Office for the Compilation of Ono City History. And the people in that archive were so kind to give me access to these reproductions. And I tried my best to decipher these journals and to make sense of them. At first, I thought it was way too daunting to deal with such a major amount of manuscript material. Most of this really hasn't been transcribed. A little bit has been, and that gave me a nice entry point. I have to say, in retrospect, the deciphering was actually the easier part. You get used to that surprisingly quickly, because there's a lot of repetition in the phrases and the characters that are being used, and especially if it's the same writer, it just gets easier and easier. What was harder was to make sense of the content, because these journals are so incredibly scattered. They just note everything in chronological order, and there are certain incidents that are that yield a lot in terms of insights into these various status groups. And then there are also small snippets of information, and you kind of get thrown in the middle of this town of 6,000 people, and you need to bring some structure to that and try to combine these fragments and gain a fuller picture of the social structure of these so far unresearched groups. There wasn't really a lot of prior research on the structure of this particular town.
Yeah, I think that's very insightful in terms of thinking about the work of historians more generally. I guess I'm still flabbergasted by the idea that this was that this 80 volume collection was a public collection that was borrowed by a historian at some point. I'm just thinking about the sort of ethical problems and the overdue fines. It just, wow, that's amazing. So I'd like to, if we could then jump a little bit into what essentially is your first chapter, which is called The Castle Town and the Domain of Ono, which lays out a history of Ono. Can you tell us a little bit more about the town? We've been talking sort of peripherally about this up till now, but what was it that I know you said that it was, you know, you were advised to take up Ono. What did you find about Ono that was, that worked for your project, that was interesting in terms of giving us insights about Toka, Japan more generally?
I think the biggest advantage about Ono, from my perspective of trying to find out more about poverty and poor relief and the structure of government more, or the operation of government more and more generally, was that it was small. It was a town of about 6,000 people in the 19th century. Very, very different from these large metropolises, Edo, Kyoto, Osaka, with in one case about 1 million people. It was just a lot less complex, and the source, and it allowed me to it was a lot more manageable in terms of research, and it was also tempting because a lot of the research on urban society that has appeared in English, had it appeared in English up to that point, and even in Japan, had focused on these large metropolises. They really had absorbed a lot of scholarly attention, whereas smaller castle towns like Ono are maybe a little bit bigger. I mean, Kanazawa is still relatively well researched, but there were very few studies of that, and I thought Ono could be an interesting example. And I also found it interesting that the town had so much interaction with the countryside. Of course, big cities like Edo and Kyoto and so on, they are also connected to the countryside. But Ono, and I mean, it was a major commercial center in this region, but at the same time, there were a lot of townspeople that were working in agriculture. There were a lot of tenants, people who rented fields near the town and worked in agriculture. Ono town served as an important function for people who lived in mountain villages. And it was also relevant for helping, supporting these people during the winter. The village poor in the mountain villages had this custom that they would go out during the winter month and support themselves through begging in the region. And quite a few of these beggars would come to Ono, and there they would have access to rice gruel kitchens and other forms of charity. The castle town was intimately connected with support of these small mountain villages, which were, of course, economically important to the castle town as well. There was a copper mine in that area, and the mountain villages supplied a variety of other commodities that Ono's townspeople were trading with. Yeah, I mean, in that sense, Ono town is, of course, not representative of even of the category of castle towns. It could never be that. But what really helped me connect it understand the significance of the various structures in this town was the fact that there were so many other scholars working on related aspects in other towns and cities. So especially people who were affiliated with the Status Marginality Project, but also others were publishing studies, for example, on Osaka's confraternities of beggar bosses, or about famine relief in the castle town of Kumamoto. And they were introducing me to certain problems and structures that I should perhaps pay attention to, or they helped me understand, if I had observed something in the case of Ono, how that might be comparable to a structure in another town. And And I try to take advantage as much as possible of these other studies on other towns to put Ono's case into context. So I try in the book to draw as many parallels as I can. And of course, the parallels look quite different depending on what aspect you look at. For example, Ono's Guild of Beggar Bosses was quite similar to the beggar guilds of Osaka, but it was very different from those of Edo. But then there are other aspects where Ono is actually quite similar to Edo and not at all like Osaka. So it turned out that that Ono, it was neither exceptional nor was it representative, but it really drew my attention to certain structures, to certain recurring themes and problems that one really needs to pay attention to when trying to understand poor relief in Tokugawa Japan.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've been talking a little bit about these so-called beggar bosses without actually getting into who they are and how they function, what they did. So I wonder if we could do that, because that's what you really do in chapters 2 and 3, chapter 2, Beggars by Birth, an outcast group in domain society, and chapter 3, The Management of Mendicancy. So you focus on the beggar bosses, the Koshiro, as a status group in Ono. Who were they? They had duties as a status group. So what were they? And of course, one of them is, as you say in the book, the management of mendicancy, which is the core and the title of chapter 3. So what's that all about?
So the Koshiro are actually the first group in Ono Town that I researched after identifying Ono as my case. What attracted me immediately, and that actually serves as an answer also to your previous question about why Ono. There is an enormous amount of material in the town elders' journals about this group, and they were very intimately involved with beggars and the management of begging. And I call them beggar bosses, which is a pretty unconventional translation, perhaps. I mean, one could also call them outcasts. These people certainly fall in this category. And what that means was that they were ostracized by the townspeople and other commoners. They couldn't intermarry with commoners. They couldn't move into the Chō communities. They couldn't join the trade and crafts guilds. And they had to be respectful towards townspeople and other commoners, and of course the samurai in many situations. And so one could discuss them as outcasts. And of course, I also highlight the discrimination that the Koshiro experience in my book. But I am in the book much more interested in their livelihood and what they did in everyday life. And in some way, they were a status group like any other. They had an occupation. And in their case, this was begging, and they were trying to monopolize that. They were granted a privilege by the domain government that they would be allowed to go around and collect alms from the domain population. And this was really it became highly regulated over time. The amounts of alms became fixed over time based on precedent. And in exchange for being allowed to collect alms, the Koshiro performed duties vis-a-vis the domain government, like other status groups also. And some of these duties were related to punishment and to the removal of pollution, and others had to do with the management of begging. So the Koshiro were in charge of running the beggar hospice in the castle town. They had to patrol the town every day to identify beggars and vagrants on the streets and to throw them out if they deemed them suspicious. And if there was a dead beggar body on town land, they had to identify and bury it. And that was a matter that a matter of order and maintaining order and control, but it was also a matter of removing pollution. And the Koshiro I mean, they can be called hinin. That's one of the main categories of outcasts in the Tokugawa society. They're the eta, the hinin, and the koshiro would fall under this label of hinin. And in that sense, they could perhaps be called a beggar guild because one way of translating hinin is beggar, the term is also used frequently in documents of the time for ordinary street beggars of uncertain background. And it's quite common for Tokugawa Hinin associations to have these unique local names. So in Ono, it's the Koshiro. In Kyoto, it's the Tojiro. In Kanazawa, it's the Tonai. And they're all slightly different. But they can all be related to this label of hinin. But I decided to call the Koshiro beggar bosses, first because the supervision of beggars was their most important contribution to local society, and it was the closest of what we would consider as work, what they did on a daily basis. And also it was very... much how they saw themselves. They didn't like to think of themselves as beggars because that would have been disrespectful or it would damage their reputation, but they saw themselves as people who performed duties for the domain government. And so they saw themselves as beggar bosses rather than beggars. And so I found it more helpful to call them beggar bosses.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it gets to the sort of core and really the title of your book, which is Give and Take, right? This question of sort of reciprocity, that they receive some sort of privileges as part of being a status group. And in return for that, there are duties. And I guess this sort of codification of status and relationship of these groups to society at large, even if it's on this sort of local scale, is you know, one of the core themes of the book. What do we learn specifically about that give and take relationship through looking at the Koshiro specifically?
So the Koshiro are actually a really good case for illustrating these reciprocal relationships, because the Ono sources with regard to the Koshiro display the interdependency between various status groups in and around the domain. And the Koshiro also allowed me to demonstrate what happened when the domain government interfered with that web of relationships. The Koshiro had customary relationships with almost all the villages in the domain and with the Chō. And in exchange for gathering arms for these communities, they performed services for them, like expelling vagrants and serving as watchmen. And oftentimes that overlapped with what they had to do anyway for the domain government as a duty. But a lot of their duties were really limited to the castle town. And what they did for the villagers was really in exchange for their gathering of arms from them. And in addition to these relationships between Koshiro and other status groups, there was the more hierarchical relationship that they had with the domain government. In order to have this public status as a status group, they needed to perform duties, like I mentioned before, and that gave them then not just a public status, but also the right to collect arms, like I mentioned. And so there are these two sets of relationships. One is between different groups of subjects, and then the other relationship is with one level of Tokugawa government, with the domain lord. And they can certainly be separated, but they were interdependent, because the Koshiro had the right to gather arms from subjects. They could make a living and perform duties for the domain, and vice versa. And so usually this was a pretty stable situation, but it wasn't always so. There were times when an imbalance occurred between these various kinds of relationships. And that happened in Ono, for example, after the Tempo famine. And after the Tempo famine, the Koshiro were no longer able to collect sufficient amounts of arms from the villages. And I think that has to do with the fact that probably village households died out during the famine, so they couldn't give as much. And that led to a shrinking of the guild. And the domain government decided to intervene because it needed the Koshiro for various duties, like the patrols, for example. They took those very seriously. And And they ended up forcing villagers to pledge a certain amount of arms that they would pay to the Koshiro every year. And this was really calculated very carefully, which village would pay how much. And they really had to make sure that they give this much and that could not no longer be regulated by customs. So it's hard to call that almsgiving anymore. It was more like a tax, like a security tax, as the Koshiro were performing these tasks in public security. But at the same time, this relationship between the villagers and the Koshiro was left intact, and the two sides could still negotiate various things with each other without interference from the domain. So although the domain government intervened, they did not profoundly change the whole structure. And there's also a very, very interesting case in which the domain government tried to get the Koshiro to perform an entirely new duty that they had not had to do before. And that was in 1852 when they ordered them to do executions for the domain. And until that point, this had been the job of the jail guard, and the jail guard didn't want to do it anymore. And the domain government tried to solve this problem by telling the Koshiro to do it, but they couldn't just order them to do it. They had to offer them something in return. And even when the Koshiro accepted that incentive, the domain also needed to be mindful of all the other reciprocal relationships that already existed between the other groups in domain society. And they had to think about how those might be affected if one disturbed the balance between them. And I don't want to go into detail here because this gets really nitty gritty, but it's quite impressive to see all the little adjustments that officials were making in this case to satisfy not just the Koshiro, but also other groups of domain subjects that interacted with them, how seriously they were taking these small agreements and how they were trying to find these ad hoc solutions to make sure that the Koshiro really would perform executions for the domain.
Yeah, this is something that I was hoping we would get to, because I found it one of the fascinating and sort of insightful pieces of your work, which is this kind of feeling that everybody is playing Jenga, that there's this very interlocked multi-level system. And if you move any of the parts, then you really have to consider what all of the other, what that means to the sort of status order and to the way that society works. So yeah, thank you for bringing that out. I wonder if we could move along to chapter 4 then, in which you deal not with the Koshiro, but with another of these status groups, the blind guilds. There were two, and the title of the chapter is The Guilds of the Blind. There were two blind guilds in Ono. There was a male guild and a female guild, which I thought was interesting in and of itself. And I wonder if you could talk about that. But can you tell us about the guilds and how were they different from the Koshiro in terms of their duties and relationship to other members of society?
So I think people who know a little bit about Tokugawa Japan are probably familiar with the guilds of the blind. And I think it's also pretty common knowledge that they had a monopoly on certain occupations like acupuncture and the performance of the koto and the shamisen string instruments, at least in case these were performed by blind people. I think is a little less known is that these guilds also defended members' right to collect certain kinds of arms, that these were also mendicant associations, like the Koshiro. They had customary rights on the collection on certain kinds of arms and rules that determined how many arms they could demand from different kinds of households. And that wasn't really something that was on my radar when I started to do this research, but it struck me that whenever there was an instance, for example, in the household of the domain lord, when there was a wedding or a funeral, that arms were given out, not just to the Koshiro, but also to the Zato and the Goze. The Zato and Goze were the only social groups in domain society, apart from the Koshiro, that were receiving arms from households in the domain on a regular basis. And yet, the Zatto in particular always tried very hard to differentiate themselves from the Koshiro. On the one hand, they repeatedly stated how important these arms were to their livelihoods. It's clear that they also this collection of arms also made them vulnerable to discrimination. Anybody who wished them ill could have pointed out that the blind guilds were really no different from the Koshiro and that they didn't deserve to be treated with respect. And the Zatto and Gozei were in many ways quite different from the Koshiro. Those were not hereditary associations. They were always replenished from the commoners. They were indeed often poor, especially in small castle towns like Ono. They were disabled, but they were, unlike the Koshiro, actually allowed to live among the townspeople. But pretty much all of them in Ono lived in the town. And at least the male Zatto were also able to marry commoner women. There was, in fact, a rule among the Gozei that they were not allowed to get married, neither with Zatto nor with commoner men. And the Zatto and Gozei were anxious to preserve these prerogatives and kept their distance from the beggar bosses. And I also found it interesting to compare the effect that the organizational structures of these various guilds had on the leverage that they enjoyed in demanding protection. Unlike the Koshiro, the Zatto had a countrywide organization. The Gozei did not. The Gozei were in most places subordinate to the local Zatto guild, but the Zatto guilds were all affiliated with a countrywide organization, the so-called Todosa. And they benefited from this affiliation because the Todosa had a headquarters in Kyoto. They had a close relationship with the shogunate, and they were able to get the group's various privileges confirmed by the shogunate. And Ono's lord couldn't just go ahead and revoke the Zatto's and Gozei's begging and other privileges if he felt like it. And this was particularly important because the Zatto and Gozei were never as useful to the domain as the Koshiro. I mean, the Koshiro, by the 19th century, by the late 18th century, really, they had evolved into a police force. They were not just taking charge of beggars, but they were investigating crime on a pretty large scale. The Zatto and Gozei, on the other hand, did not perform any significant duty other than the fact that they were controlling their own members, and that was a duty that was expected from every status group in Tokugawa society, but it wasn't really that important to the domain. And that's probably the reason why the domain government didn't step in as forcefully on behalf of almsgiving to the blind as it did on behalf of almsgiving to the Koshiro. So we saw in my response to your earlier question, the domain actually trying to fix or even to raise the amount of arms that people had to give. So the blinds, the guilds of the blind, explicitly had to refer to their blindness and appeal to the lords and society's compassion to get the protections that they needed. So although Koshiro and the guilds of the Koshiro and the guilds of the blind are both examples of mendicant groups, they were operating under pretty different circumstances, and they tried to manipulate the conventions of the status order in different ways.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you have these different groups that are interacting with society, and sort of, you know, setting up this contrast between the two of them helps to kind of triangulate the ways that different status groups, particularly these mendicant groups and sort of marginal status groups, interacted with society as a whole at different levels. Chapters 5 and 6, then, chapter 5, benevolence, charity, or duty, hunger relief in the castle town, and chapter 6, growth through gratitude, welfare in a mercantilist domain, shift your focus to different kinds of poverty and disaster management. And so your overall interest in the relationships between civil society and government and the ways that poverty is sort of dealt with in a reciprocal way and society doesn't change, but some of the actors and dynamics do. So I wonder if we could move on to chapters 5 and 6. And partially because famine features prominently in both chapters, I'd like to kind of start with that. Chapter 5 looks at the changes to relief efforts for the poor that took place as a result of the Temme famine, which came in the late 18th century. Could you first tell us about the famine itself and the broader significance of that famine, also famines more generally in considering Edo period history? Specifically in chapter 5, you show that aid for the poor and for the disaster stricken changed in tangible ways as a result of the Temme famine. So what happened and why? And is this a short-term ad hoc change? Is it part of a bigger shift in ideologies and methodologies surrounding aid for the poor and poverty-stricken? And does that mean a change in attitudes about poverty and the poor themselves?
Yeah, so the Temme famine was one of the biggest famines of the Tokugawa period. It lasted for several years. There were several years of harvest failures between 1782 and 1788. And it caused rioting in many towns and cities, including Edo. And that was the most traumatizing for the shogunate. It really intimidated the shogunate into action. And then under Matsudaira Sadanobu, during the Kansei reform, emergency relief fund for Edo's townspeople was created, the so-called Machi Kaisho, that then became one of the more successful relief mechanisms of the Tokugawa period. And in the course of this reform, the shogunate also forced all daimyo across the country to establish some kind of permanent relief fund in their domains. And the reason why I decided to peel apart the operation of starvation relief through the example of this famine was in part that the Temme famine was a turning point in how this was organized, but also because a famine is a moment of acute crisis. And the mechanisms that regulate poverty in normal times no longer function because simply the number of starving people is too high and social order threatens to break down because people leave their communities for survival. So this is a quite exceptional moment. And it is during this moment that a lot of mechanisms in Ono's town society get activated that one doesn't really see so clearly in normal times, or maybe they are not even operating in normal times. And so this became also a window for me on Ono's town society. And I said earlier that when I started out, I didn't really know very much about the specifics of this town society, how the various organizations in town society, the status groups, how they collaborated with the town elders and then by extension with the domain government. So I actually learned a lot about town society in general through researching this particular chapter. And so what I found what I was trying to do in this chapter was to look not so much at how the domain government dealt with the crisis. There are, of course, some documents on that as well, and that has been the focus of a lot of previous research. But I was more curious to learn more about the social bodies in town society and how they interacted with each other to resolve this crisis. And in the Temme famine in 1783 and especially in 1784, what the townspeople did was to establish a collection mechanism of donations for the entire town population. And they had not really done that before at that point. And the most important group of townspeople that made the biggest contribution to this pooling of donations was an organization called the Purveyor Guild, the Goyotashi Nakama. And this was an organization of wealthy merchants that had existed previously, and they played various roles in town society. They performed various duties, and they ended up collecting most of the donations for the starving. And then the domain leadership also came up with a mechanism by which all the Cho communities would supply donations. And the Cho communities were generally responsible for aiding the poor among themselves. But in this case, they would actually pool all the donations, and then they would be distributed among all the town poor at once that had applied for relief. So and this was a new way of regulating charity in the town. And it was quite innovative because charity among townspeople in Ono had so far been mostly informal. Wealthy townspeople were giving to the poor, but most of this charity tended to go to poor people who happened to be their neighbors or maybe their tenants. And that was a problem not just in Ono, but we see that also in Edo and in other Japanese cities in the 18th century, that charity happens, but it's unregulated. It's not always going where it needs to go. Also because there's this growing disparity between rich and poor in the towns and cities of the time. And we see other cities addressing this problem a lot sooner than Ono. In Osaka, for example, they establish a mechanism that's pretty similar to Ono, this regulated charity in the 1730s during the Kyō famine. But in Ono, it happens during Temmei. And I think it's partly because Ono simply wasn't economically as highly developed as Osaka was in the 1730s. And so all over the country, there is this trend in the 18th century of urban famine relief becoming more organized, becoming more formalized, and requiring more formal collaboration between samurai administrators and wealthy townspeople. So in this chapter, I try to emphasize how the status order still plays a major role in structuring these new relationships and making these new solutions possible. And that it is a mechanism of government that is actually flexible enough to explore such new approaches. And you asked about the changing attitudes towards the poor. And that was something that I was always hoping to get at more. And I wish I was able to say a little more about it because I'm very interested in it. But one thing that seems fairly clear is that in the 18th century, administrators were starting to find it less and less appropriate to have townspeople beg on the streets. And it's for other cities, for example, Kyoto in the 17th century, it's very common when there's a famine that townspeople would go out and they would ask for alms, or they would line up for soup kitchens. And then they would, of course, have to mingle with ordinary beggars who did not have a home and who were a lot less respectable than townspeople with a home. And in the 17th century, that seems to have been pretty common because during a famine, soup kitchens really were the most common organized way to deal with to help starving townspeople. And then in the 18th century, I'm beginning to see more evidence that people were bothered by that sort of thing. One Confucian scholar in Kyoto, for example, Miwa Kiken, wrote a tract in which he complained about ordinary townspeople having to mingle with beggars and standing in line for a soup kitchen. And in Fukui, there is a report from the Temmei famine that townspeople who went out begging covered their faces to conceal their identity. And So by institutionalizing charity in the way that I just described, it became possible to move people away from soup kitchens and help people get aid where they resided. And Ono domain did have soup kitchens. Actually, every winter the domain was doing this. That seems to have increasingly become something that was considered relief for beggars. And of course, this, moving people away from soup kitchens was also a precaution against rioting. And when Ono eventually abolished Ono Domain eventually abolished the domain soup kitchens in the 1860s. That happens much, much later than the Temme famine, but eventually they abolished them. And one reason seems to have been that the town society was quite restless during those years, and they were trying to make sure that there was as little potential for rioting as possible.
That's very interesting. And it also provides a great segue into your chapter 6, where you're really talking about the 19th century in Ono. And here in chapter 6, you're analyzing changes to poverty management in the early part of the 19th century. You highlight two really important interrelated factors here, the Tempo famine of the 1830s, and a mercantilist shift in the domain's economic politics. Can you tell us about both of those and about their effects on poverty management in Ono?
So it's very interesting to compare the Temme famine and the Tempo famine in the 1830s, because their impact on Ono's local society seems to have been quite different. For the Temme famine, I did not see a whole lot of evidence that crime went up, that the social order was breaking down. But during the Tempo famine, that was a completely different picture. There was a lot of vagrancy and a lot of crime that turned out to have been committed by local vagrants who were active in the region. And I'm not entirely sure why and what happened in the interim, or whether there was something about the famine that was completely different. But I largely see this as the result of a slow change in the society of that region that probably had something to do with commercialization and economic crisis in the villages. It's hard to really definitely connect the two, but I think there probably was a connection. And both famines took a lot of lives. I don't know how many in the case of the Temme famine, but there are figures for Tempo. And according to domain records, close to 5,000 people probably died out of a population of 29,000. And of course, that was seen as a very critical moment for the domain. I mean, the domain government, like most other domains at the time, they had had budgetary problems, major budgetary problems since the 18th century. And after the famine, the domain had an even bigger mountain of debt, and they were facing this big population loss and loss of productivity and major poverty among its subjects. And that's really one big factor why the domain government took up mercantilist reform in the 1840s. And they saw that really as a matter of survival for the domain and trying to get rid of the debt, remedy poverty among subjects. And these domain reform, this domain reform continued for a quite long time. It went on and off until and even beyond the Meiji Restoration, until the domain was abolished. And it very clearly went hand in hand with a rethinking about how to address poverty. So it's very striking the domain suddenly put a major emphasis on growing the population and on making that population more productive. And the officials started to pay more attention to poor relief. So helping the people as a way to help the domain economy. And Ono's domain officials also showed a striking new interest in healthcare that hadn't been there before. Especially they promoted smallpox vaccinations and a hospital, and there was a lot of engagement with Western medicine, with Dutch learning. And again, I mean, they saw this as a way to grow the population and to make that population grateful and involve them in contributing to the prosperity of the domain. So they were using this idea of benevolent rule as a tool to discipline domain subjects in a way, like bribing the population. They argued explicitly that healthcare and generous poor relief would create a debt toward the government that the subjects should repay with diligent and productive labor. And they made that argument again and again and again in the 60s in particular. And I mean, a lot of this thinking wasn't as new as I just made it out to be. Of course, this idea of this ideology of benevolent rule had been around for a long time, and it's not like healthcare had not before been considered part of the Lord's responsibilities for his subjects. But it was never implemented very thoroughly, and the government suddenly, after the temple famine, started to intensify and integrate all these ideas to make them part of all these strategies to make them part of a larger plan to lift up the domain economy. And they the government became a lot more involved and coercive and bureaucratic towards its subjects to make that happen. So that does remind one quite a bit of Michel Foucault's idea of biopolitics. And this reform did, in some sense, have a beneficial effect on onus domain poor. They were a lot more likely to get support from the government, but they were also being disciplined and supervised to an unprecedented degree. And I want to add maybe a little bit on how this then translates into the Meiji period. This particular reform ended pretty abruptly when the shogunate fell and then the domain was abolished. So on the surface, there seems to have been quite a rupture between Tokugawa and Meiji. But I then looked a little bit into the first decades of Meiji. There are much fewer sources than for Tokugawa, but I tried my best. And I found that these reforms and their way of dealing with poverty actually foreshadowed quite a bit of what then happened in the first half of Meiji, and especially with regard to the focus on public health, where local elites directly tried to build on these earlier attempts of the domain lord to fund that on the local level. And then this focus on economic development, trying to create employment for the local poor. I think if there was really one large change that impacted the situation of the poor was the abolition of the status groups, and especially the mendicant status groups like the Zato and the Goze and the Koshiro. These groups were all completely abolished, and begging was prohibited in this prefecture as well as in other prefectures in the Meiji period. And that was really a very radical change in the way in which the poor were traditionally supported also take their own influence their own situation to some degree by gaining some autonomy for themselves.
Yeah, thank you for adding that part about the sort of Tokugawa Meiji transition, because I think it's very helpful in complicating some of these ideas that we have about the ways that transition plays out, but also specifically in thinking about the abolition of these status groups and the kind of effects that it had on society, and how that plays into the sort of creation of modern Japan, which I have to say is, you know, of course, as you know, sort of my particular interest. So that's very helpful for me personally as well. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, you started to hint that, you know, you've been looking beyond the scope of the book strictly. I don't know if you'd like to tell us about a project that you're working on now. Are you continuing with this work? Are you working on something new?
Okay, so my second project, I think in a way it's a continuation of what I've been doing, but it also takes me far beyond Ono domain itself and to completely new subjects. So this domain reform that I've been talking about actually has gotten a lot of attention from local historians in Ono in particular. It's been a matter of local pride, really, because the domain was doing pretty unusual things that were especially unusual for a domain of this size. The domain government asked the shogunate for permission to engage in the colonization of Kita Ezochi, of today's island of Sakhalin. And they got into pretty difficult interactions with the Russian Empire. They also, even though they were not really located on the coast, they bought a Western-style sailing ship and they learned how to operate it, even though most of the people that were in charge of it didn't really know how to sail a Western-style ship or any ship at all for that matter. And then they started a trading company that became quite successful. It was run by samurai and it established branches all over the country, and it even survived into the Meiji period and was really quite successful. So these initiatives have gotten a lot of attention, and in, so far I stayed clear from them for the most part because I was less interested in what domain officials were doing. And I was certainly not interested in lionizing the people who were in charge of these domain of these reforms, but I was interested in the poor and what these domain reforms meant for their situation. But I think in my second project I should actually look at that a little more, because I think these reforms are very, very interesting, and they allow me to look more closely at the concept of a domain, what a domain actually is and what it does. The way that the domain suddenly starts to almost morph into a commercial enterprise during that time, and how domain officials interacted with local merchants in the various cities and towns in which they acted and tried to trade, and how they were trying to plug themselves into the trading networks along the Sea of Japan, the Kitamae Bune, and so on, and how they were trying to interact with foreigners. And I think there is a lot to be discovered, and I think it makes sense to also stay with the same domain, because I've gotten a pretty good sense of the archive there, and of course there are still a lot of sources that I haven't touched. There is a major collection of sources on the domain government that is probably larger than what exists for the town. It's something that I will continue to look into further, and it really does help that I have this background on this particular domain, and I hope to make that productive for my second project also.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely fascinating. I love this idea that you just put out there of the domain essentially transforming itself into some kind of commercial enterprise. That's really interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that turns out. And we're, I think, going to have to wrap up here. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, and thanks for being with us on the podcast.